everyone. This is Teresa Ballou. I'm the president of South by Southwest Injury Prevention Network, and we want to welcome you and thank you for joining the first call in our series on communicating about injury and violence prevention. There will be technical support available during the call, and they've been, of course, setting this up for us, Children's Safety Network, and we are very grateful and indebted to them. Rebecca, who works on this, and all of her team there for making this possible and this resource available, so thank you very much. Just keep in mind that this series will continue next month on the 27th of August, and we'll hear about CDC's Heads Up campaign, and then again on October 22nd to discuss framing for communication about policy. Both of those calls are at the same time. Today's call features Deborah Grafik, who's the Director of Social and Behavior Sciences in the Department of Preventive Medicine at the Uniformed Services University of Health Sciences. I want to pause just for a minute and let Rebecca come on. She may have some technical issues to cover with you all. And so, Rebecca, let us know what, if anything, we need to do at this point.
Thanks, Teresa. There are two options here today's audio. You can either listen through your computer speakers or you can call into our phone line at 866-835-7973. If you're participating over the phone, please mute your computer speakers to eliminate echo. Phone lines will be muted during the presentation to eliminate background noise. If you have a question or are experiencing any technical difficulties, please type them into the chat box on the left and we will attempt to assist you. If you're having any problems joining the webinar, please contact the Adobe Connect hotline at 1-800-416-7640. The phone number is also available above the slide deck. You can submit questions and comments at any time during the presentation in the chat box. After the presentation, we will pause for the presenter to answer your questions. This meeting will be recorded and archived and sent out to all registrants.
Okay, thank you, Rebecca. And now, be sure that, again, that you use the chat box function for questions. There will be time for questions at the end of the presentation, and we are very, very honored to have Dr. Grafik with us today, and we're looking forward to what all she has to say and share with us. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Teresa, and I want to thank Jennifer Woody for inviting me. It's an honor to be talking to you all who do such important work. I work for the government, like many of you do, so I need to start with the disclaimer that the views I share with you today are my opinions, and I don't necessarily reflect the official views of the Uniformed Services University of the Health Sciences, which is where I work, or the Department of Defense. So I'm going to begin by sharing a drawing that my daughter did when she was either in first grade or kindergarten. And the assignment to the students was to illustrate a class rule. And I chose this image because it represents, I think, a fairly typical, traditional approach to safety promotion. You have to forgive her, this was pre-spell check. But you'll see what it does is it tells you what you should not do, okay? This is her way of saying no running at all times. You see the safety guard telling the kids not to run. And it warns you with what will happen if you break the safety rule. The other trait that this communication shares with most injury prevention materials out there is that it has not been evaluated. Okay, so that might be a good thing because I'm quoting here from Alan Williams, who's the former chief scientist for the Insurance Institute for Highway Safety. Most public information and education programs that have been evaluated in terms of injury reduction have not produced a measurable reduction. And that's because, in Alan's opinion, and I share his view, too often public information and education programs are really based on the naive assumption that all you need to do is to urge people to do the healthy thing, and that will lead them to do that behavior. But we now have a lot of evidence, research and evaluation evidence, that shows that this approach typically fails as a standalone approach. But it does allow program organizers or funders to think that they dealt with the problem. And so what I'm going to try to encourage you to do is to base your efforts on some more of a data-driven approach, more of an evidence base. And some of you may be thinking, well, I sound like a typical researcher, a typical academic. We always want to collect more data, and that I'm not aware of some of the fiscal constraints that you might have to operate under. And you're right. Some of the approaches I will encourage do cost money, but I feel very strongly that there's a good chance you'll be wasting the limited dollars that are devoted to injury if you don't work from any type of a data or evidence base. In addition to resources being inadequate, I think one reason that evaluation doesn't really take place is that there's kind of an insidious barrier to research and communications. And to illustrate this point, I have taken this from the CDC, if it looks familiar to you. It's really their recommended game plan for how to tackle any public health problem. So they say you should define the problem, identifying the risk factors that are associated with the problem, test an intervention, and then when you know what works, try to get people to adopt it. And that, you know, it's really hard to argue with that approach. But if you look more closely at a detailed description of how they define each of those tasks, you'll start to see what I'm getting at. So for number one, define the problem, they say you need to gather and analyze the data. For number two, to identify the risk and protective factors, they recommend conduct and support research. To test an intervention, they say you need to study the effect of the intervention. But when you get to step number four, they say share what you have learned. So I think there's a general opinion that you need a scientist for the first three steps of this public health approach, but at the end, you just, you know, hand over the last step to the public affairs staff, and it will take care of itself. And what I would hope is that more professionals join me in conceptualizing communications as another phase of injury prevention research, rather than what happens after the scientists have done their job. And I think that right now, really insufficient resources are being devoted to the communications aspect of injury research. And I should say I'm talking about, you know, the modern approach, the public health approach to injury control. 50 or 75 years ago, when our field was called accident prevention, then communications were pretty much the only means that people used to try to prevent injuries. And we're definitely more successful now that we take a public health approach. But I think that the pendulum may have swung too far in the other direction. So people pay very little attention to how they communicate to the public. And I think it leads to a vicious cycle. So people say, oh, communications programs are not that effective. I think that's because not enough of them are evidence-based. And so people don't want to spend money on them because they think they're not effective. And let me show you some of the results. I'm going to be sharing some findings with you today of what can happen when we don't evaluate or add an evaluation component to communications. So this data I'm going to share with you is from a national survey that I carried out in 1996. And one of the questions on that survey was, has increasing the legal drinking age from 18 to 21 saved any lives? Now, hopefully in the audience there, I have people that know the answers to that question. And in fact, this law that was passed in 1975 has saved tens of thousands of lives. And we could be pretty confident about that conclusion because minimum drinking age laws have been called perhaps the most thoroughly studied alcohol control policy in U.S. history. And the Congress, for example, had a GAO study of that. They spent a lot of money. But apparently not enough money was spent telling the American public what these laws had accomplished. So when I polled the general public about whether these laws have saved any lives at all, they were pretty much evenly divided. CSC, 49% felt that they had saved lives. 48% felt that they hadn't saved any lives. And only 3% of people said they didn't know. I see two very important lessons in this finding. One is that the dissemination part of our work is not automatic. So after the EPI study has been done, whose job is it to tell the good news story? When we don't share that, I think we lose ground, as we've done in our country for, say, motorcycle helmet laws, many of which have been repealed. So my first kind of lesson, and I've tried to boil down some of my major key take-home points today into these kind of lessons, is that I think we need to take responsibility for and assign some resources to educating the public and policymakers about what does work? And again, I think, you know, some research dollars go into testing things, ideally, but then do we tell people this saved this many lives or this prevented this many deaths? Obviously, there's a lot of potential benefit in terms of people adopting a measure because they believe that it's effective and also having communities and politicians support it. I think a more subtle benefit that could come from sharing these types of results are that we could move people away from thinking of injuries just as a problem that is the sole responsibility of the individual at risk, that they're the only people who have to take action to prevent injuries. The second aspect of those results that I wanted to point to and emphasize is the fact that 97% of respondents thought that they knew whether the law had been effective. Okay, remember, half those people were wrong, so you can't say that they had knowledge because it was wrong, but they had a belief, right? And the fallacy of the empty vessel refers to the fact that many campaigns operate under the assumption that people's heads are like empty cups, and they're sitting in the community waiting for the professional to come along and fill them with wisdom. And that leads me to my next take-home point. Before we need to change people's knowledge or their beliefs or their attitudes, we need to assess what they believe to begin with. And, you know, forgive me if some of this seems basic to you. I know a lot of you have been in the field for a while and you, you know, are well-trained and have sophisticated notions, but I have a hunch that you run into this with some of the people you work with or work for, okay, these notions. So I'm hoping that some of what I share with you today will be useful arguments you can use to get them to let you take a more data-driven approach. So, you know, I'm referring here to kind of in health ed jargon, to a needs assessment. And it might seem obvious that you would design a different campaign for someone who, say, thinks that seatbelts don't work versus someone who wears them only when they're on a highway. But I think that this notion of taking like a before picture of the target audience is not always, or I would say even usually, done. So let me, again, show you some examples of what can happen when we don't do a needs assessment before we try to change attitudes or beliefs. This probably looks familiar to many of you. A lot of energy in our field has been spent trying to convince people that, quote, injuries aren't accidents. And this logo that you're looking at came from the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration. They were sharing it with the media. And this started in, I believe, 1996, when they banned their employees from using the word accident. And they cited their objection as the fact that the word accident plays into public misconceptions that accidents just happen and can't be prevented. So again, NHTSA felt that's what accidents meant, and they were trying to change that perspective. And that approach has a lot of face validity, but as it turns out, it wasn't data-based. That belief on the part of NHTSA was, again, not data-driven. And I want to point out, using this example, that many highly respected epidemiologists for decades were willing to operate just on a hunch about this issue, and many people still feel strongly this word shouldn't be used. I don't think people would operate on a hunch if we were trying to change a vehicle or, you know, a road design. They would want data. But yet when it comes to communications, they were fine with objecting to this word when they weren't relying on data. And again, this quote here is from an article that names the top five reasons that mass media campaigns have been shown to have limited effectiveness. And this one says that messages are often dictated by the advertiser's hypotheses rather than having a focus on empirical research. So had NHTSA looked at the literature on the word accident, there wasn't a lot, but they would have seen that 6 years before they banned the word, Marty Eichelberger and colleagues at National Safe Kids and the Children's Hospital had done a survey where they asked people whether most accidents were preventable, and they found that almost 90% of parents already agreed that most injuries or accidents were preventable. And I say injuries or accidents because they used a very clever design. They asked half the people whether they used the word accidents, and half the people they used the word injuries. And what they found, there was no difference in whether or not parents thought they were preventable. So you know, that tells us really that the word accident does not mean unpreventable to the vast majority of people. But the professionals thought that it did, and they were just going on a hunch and an assumption. I also, this was a small part of my dissertation that I did in 1996, and I got very similar results. So the Safe Kids study, which was just talking about childhood injuries, found that 87% of parents thought they were preventable. Mine was dealing with fatal injuries in general. I found 83%. That same year, a study was published in Canada, which found 85% of parents in Ontario agreed with the statement, most accidents are avoidable. And this appears to be quite a robust finding. In Europe, in China, and in Brazil, they've all found that 4 out of 5 people already believe that injuries and accidents are preventable. So my point here isn't let's all start using the word accident more, but my point is that we had not measured our target audience's baseline belief, and we were just assuming how a message was being interpreted by the public. And that leads to my next sort of advice or lesson, which is we need to pretest our messages in advance of their final production or the final dissemination. And when I say pretest, you really have a lot of options of what that could look like. You could do focus groups, you could do surveys or questionnaires, you could do theater testing, which is just having people together in a group and you show them, you know, a PSA or something you were planning to use. You could do intercept interviews where you approach people in a natural setting, like a mall or a beach or, you know, a racetrack, somewhere that it's logical for the audience you're trying to reach. Or you could do behavioral observation where, you know, say you were testing signage in a national park. You could vary the sign and then observe what people do. So obviously this can get into research design issues, but there's a lot of ways that you could try to get input from your audience. And I'm going to use another example to show you kind of a mistakes or traps you can fall in if you don't pretest your message. So that survey I talked about earlier that I did in 1996, its purpose was to understand what the public's pre-existing views were on how each major type of fatal unintentional injury could be prevented. And when we talked about unintentional poisoning, it became clear that my respondents, when they were thinking about poisoning, were thinking about the scenario of a toddler getting into detergent or under the sink, that type of thing. When I asked them what age group they thought was at greatest risk for dying of accidental poisoning, 65% of respondents said young children. Now, certainly, toddlers are at great risk developmentally of taking a toxic substance and eating it or drinking it, but when it comes to fatal poisonings, in the United States, at that time of the survey, in fact, 99% of the victims were older than the age of 14. In fact, 65% were between the ages of 30 and 50. So you can see that if you just use the word poisoning in your campaign, and you're thinking of the scenario shown on the right, and they're thinking of the scenario shown on the left, that you could run into problems and misinterpretation. Now, my next example is going to be drawn from the world of violence prevention, and I probably, you know, need to apologize a bit to my colleagues who work on violence issues because that's not the area I work in. So many of my examples are drawn from unintentional injury programs, but I think that that my messages are generic, and so hopefully you'll still find them to be useful. Okay, again, still trying to make the point that we need to pretest our messaging before we deliver it out there. I'm going to refer to a study that was published last year in Health Marketing Quarterly. And the name of the study was Doing More Harm Than Good, Negative Health Effects of Intimate Partner Violence Campaigns. And for this study, they used qualitative methods. So the authors held 10 focus groups with 4 to 6 women each. And the groups were diverse ethnically and racially. They were drawn from states that were pretty diverse. They had Wisconsin, Texas, and California. All of the participants in the focus groups had experienced intimate partner violence or abuse. Each focus group looked at real TV ads, print ads, and radio ads that had been utilized in a Intimate Partner Violence campaign, public service campaign, in the last 10 years. And the materials covered different formats. So there's drama, there was lecture, there was testimonials. And what they found is that for 97% of the women, they had a negative response to the ads. It evoked a negative emotion for these women. And that was true of 75% of the TV ads. And that didn't matter on the woman's race, how long she'd been in her abusive relationship, what region of the country she was from, her age. They had negative emotions. So the type of emotions that these ads evoked for these women were, first of all, shame. The authors say that the women felt that the images heightened their level of shame and actually made them feel more determined not to reveal the truth surrounding their circumstances to anyone. Some stated they felt a heightened sense of denial because they did not want to be connected to the images they saw in the ads. One study participant said, "They look victimized, downtrodden, pathetic. I wouldn't want to say that was me, even if it was, which it isn't. These ads are disgusting and shameful, and if you think there's anyone that's going to feel empowered or better about herself as a result of these, you're nuts." Okay, the other emotions they found is that the ads scared women. One woman said, "I mean, my son sat there and screamed just like that, and I was begging and pleading while their dad was getting louder and louder just like that. I don't like looking at that and hearing it because it brings back that feeling of absolute terror. I don't need to relive the fear over and over again. I wouldn't want to watch that." Some women were angry. "I think, how dare you represent me in this way? The whole concept is insulting and stereotypical." And for some women, the ads made them feel more hopeless. "For me, this makes it just seem like I'm stuck. It really represents a hopeless picture. These ads are just too discouraging. Every time I would watch these kind of ads, I just wanted to give up and not think about it. They made me feel like there was nothing I could do. They didn't show me how my life could be better." Okay, now you know that probably a lot of money went into those campaigns, and a lot of time, and a lot of good intentions. But if they were targeted to women who were currently in abusive relationships, isn't it a shame that they didn't do this type of work in advance to test their messaging to see how it was coming across to their target audience? The next point I wanted to make is that if risk communication is going to be effective, the target audience has to find the message to be relevant to them, okay? And, you know, that came up a little in the quotes we just read, but I see a lot of campaigns that I'm not sure who would identify with the person that they show in the ad. It's very easy to find safety materials that suggest the injury victims are stupid. So here you have the dog is wearing a life jacket and the man on the boat is not. This came from a campaign called Smooth Operator. Some of you may be familiar with it. You may have worked on it. It is a campaign that's been run since 1997 in D.C., Maryland, and Virginia, and its purpose is to reduce aggressive driving. And this ad was the approach they took in 2004. So again, I just said that we want people who see the ad to identify with it. Look at that picture. I don't know who would identify with that, but I know when they evaluated the campaign, they found that most drivers did not see themselves as having driven aggressively during the last 30 days, despite the fact that nearly everyone who responded had done one of the things that the campaign producers defined as aggressive driving. So, okay, the people that saw their ads were not identifying with being aggressive drivers. That's not surprising to me when this is how you show an aggressive driver, right? Who thinks that's what they're like? Interestingly, in 2006, they changed their campaign, and this is what they did. And I'm not sure that you guys can read that gray font that is in the white background, but it says things like, "I'm a son, I'm a mother, I'm a sports fan, I'm a lawyer, I'm a teacher, I'm a nurse, I'm a student, I'm a friend, I'm an aggressive driver." Totally different, right, in terms of letting the audience identify with the target audience that this campaign is directed at. So do you think the results were better? Well, in 2006, they found that for 10 t- types of aggressive driving that they were interested in, they showed improvement. And those improvements were significant for the ones I have listed here: driving in a way someone might call aggressive, driving at least 15 miles over the speed limit, cutting in front of other cars, and running a stop sign. I'm not sure how the results varied by socioeconomic status, but I do know when you use a narrative, when you use someone telling their story, at least one study by Kruder has found that the narrative approach is more effective with, he found, with women that had a lower education as opposed to higher education. Okay, many of you might have heard about tailoring, and from what I could read about tailoring, it has shown some good effects in the field of injury prevention, though most of the work has not been done in injury. Like it sounds, tailoring means creating really an individualized or personalized communication. And so what you normally have is the person would fill out some type of a kind of a survey or answer some questions on a computer, and that allows you to generate an individualized communication for them. So I'm going to show you this example. It's actually borrowed from Andrea Gielen at Johns Hopkins, and this was something they did. They had kiosks, and women would fill in their information, and you see that Don, that's the name of this person's child, under the questions and answers, it talks about Baltimore, which is the city the people live in. It shows the hospital they go to. So again, this is personalized to them. And this is summarized from a kind of an overview review study about tailoring and whether it works. And they did find that there is a benefit, a modest benefit, to using tailoring. The odds ratio was 1.2, so it's not huge. But they found that tailoring was more effective when you were working on prevention, I guess, as opposed to treatment. When you contacted the people more than one time, when you recruited people from their household as opposed to a health setting, if you tailored it on greater than 4 theoretical constructs. Okay, and this idea of looking at the literature for what works and using theory to design your study, you know, it does receive support in the literature. And again, looking at where they stand on theory, and I know many of you are probably familiar with, you know, stages of change or health belief model, social cognitive theory. If you're not, if you don't have that type of training, you should try to really work perhaps with a, if there's a school of public health in your area, and understand how you might measure some of those things so that you could target them in your campaign. Okay, the next point I wanted to make was that fear, how to use fear effectively. It's one of the decisions we're all faced with when we develop an injury prevention campaign. Should we try to scare the audience, right? And there was a time, again, where a lot of gore and a lot of sort of violence was shown to scare people. And definitely when I was first trained in injury, the belief was that didn't work. I think now the message is a bit more nuanced now that science has advanced. And fear can be effective, but it has to be used in the right way. And this comes again from theory, specifically the extended parallel processing model. And they have found that you need to emphasize the severity of the outcome and the likelihood of the threat. So again, it's okay to talk about specific severe consequences that can result, but it needs to be coupled with an efficacy message. So that means you need to get the audience to believe that they're capable of performing the recommended response. And also to get them to believe that it will work. So if you just scare them and leave them there, period, that's not effective. It's not even ethical. But if you are able to elevate their risk perception and then get them to believe that there's something they can do that will work and that they're capable of doing it, then that has been shown to be effective. But when you evaluate a campaign like that, don't just look at the outcome. Did they change their behavior or did you reduce injuries? You need to also measure these intermediary outcomes, like did you get them to believe the outcome was severe, that it could happen to them, and that they could, in fact, you know, carry out the preventive recommendation and it would work. So, again, I just think it's hard to use fear effectively. It can be used effectively, but you have to be careful. It has been shown with some populations, like young men or risk takers, to boomerang and to have the opposite effect. Which brings me to my next point, is obviously I'm a fan of evaluation since I'm talking a lot about being data-driven. But we need to measure both the intended consequences, what we thought and hoped would happen after our campaign, but also unintended consequences. What's something we didn't intend to happen, but you know, we could have done. And if you're not sure, you know, what could happen, go wrong in your campaign, you need look no further than your critics, right? Because the people who are opposed to your campaign will tell you what their fears are. They may worry that people will drive more recklessly if we make the vehicle safer. They may worry that parents will stop supervising their children if you put a fence around the pool. So again, try when you're measuring not just to measure what you hope you changed, but things you might have changed by accident or inadvertently. So here's, again, another example of something that may have an outcome that we didn't think about or we didn't mean. So this message that injuries are preventable, right? We believe that or we wouldn't be in this field, and we try to spread that word to people. But what are the social effects of increasing the public's perception of injury preventability? Well, if you review the social psych or risk perception literature, you find that the more preventable people think that something is, the more likely they have an optimistic bias about that threat. And optimistic bias, really as the name implies, is just the erroneous belief that your own risk is less than other people's risk. And this is very, very well documented. There's over 100 studies which show that we walk around thinking, even if we do the same thing, risky thing as another person, we're less likely to get injured. So the more preventable they think something is, the more likely they are to believe it won't happen to them. Also, that people think things that are controllable, that we already know how to control, are less serious and therefore less deserving of strict regulation. And people also like to pay less for government programs if the victims could have protected themselves from that threat. So, you know, these are just, again, consequences of stressing the preventability message that we might not have thought about. And, you know, food for thought, but I guess my point is here that we need to evaluate and good things and bad things that could have resulted from our campaign. Besides the fact that, as I've shown, most people seem to already believe that injuries are preventable, so maybe that message has gotten out there for most people. Okay, my next lesson I wanted to mention, and I always feel the need to mention this when I talk about risk communication, is you need to step back and think about whether that's even the most effective or appropriate avenue of prevention. Okay, so education campaigns are very popular. Politically, they're not controversial usually, and we get a lot of pressure to do them. But if we want to keep our eye on the prize in terms of reducing injuries, sometimes just take a moment to step back and think of whether or not education, or certainly education alone, is what is necessary. And I'm going to show you some examples, as I have been doing throughout this talk. When I was training at Hopkins, I worked on a campaign that had to do with increasing low-income women's use of stair gates. And we did a needs assessment before that campaign, and we had focus groups and asked women where they would even buy a stair gate. So again, if we were effective in convincing them to get one, where would they buy it? Because that neighborhood definitely at that time did not have anything like a Target or a department store. It was a low-income urban neighborhood. And the women said they would go to Towson, which is a suburb, which is probably 25 or 40 minutes away. They tended to not have cars, so they would take the bus. Kind of by definition, if they need a stair gate, they would have a toddler. And I went to that Towson, and I looked at the stair gates. And most of them, if you read the fine print on the back of the stair gate, said not for use on top of stairs. Okay, because they were pressure gates. They wouldn't have been safe on top of stairs. You really need the type that screws into the wall. And so the few they had that would have been safe for the top of stairs were the most expensive gates. They cost over $40, and they were in a huge box. So think about a woman needing to, like, get on a bus holding hands with a toddler, even if she could afford the gate, with a huge box. It's not that practical. It's not that feasible. So luckily, part of that intervention was being able to sell safety products at cost in the neighborhood of the hospital to make it more, you know, to enable that behavior for women. We need to make the behavior that we're recommending be easy. And so if we just were encouraging women to do this, but it wasn't really possible in their environment, then that's not really ethical and that's not likely to be successful. In this example, we're talking about a behavior that's possible for the audience, but it's just not convenient, and so they're not going to do it. And again, the fix for this problem turned out to be engineering, okay, not just communication. So in that case, this is a pedestrian bridge, which we would like people to use so they don't cross that busy, dangerous road. Well, they found that only 6% of people were using that bridge when there were traffic signals under the bridge. But when they installed an elevator, 63% began using it. So again, they might have had a lot of posters around saying to use the bridge, but if it's just too inconvenient for people, that's the perception they're not going to use it. But you do see here that perceptions came into play. So pedestrians who thought the bridge was safe were more likely to use it. There were studies done in India where women were not using the pedestrian bridge, which was closed, unlike this one in this picture, because they felt they were could be subject to attack or robbery when they got into the bridge because it was dark. And so, you know, again, I'm trying to show this example to say don't assume, don't jump on communication as a standalone, because the problem may be something different and, in fact, easier to fix than changing people's perceptions or attitudes. The flip side of that message is even when you have a policy change or a technical innovation, don't assume there's no communications component. Usually there is. Usually in our field, if we've learned anything, is that, you know, a combined strategy works best. So I'll give you some examples. I'm sure you're all familiar with Click It or Ticket, right? It's one of the most, probably the most successful campaign to get people to wear seatbelts. And it was first launched in North Carolina in 1993, and now it's, I believe it's in the whole United States. And the idea of this is to increase enforcement, right, and increase drivers' perceived risk of being ticketed for not wearing their seatbelt. So when this program was being evaluated, it was, at this point, I think, carried out in 18 states when this evaluation took place, and the states were doing different levels of fidelity to how it was recommended. So here's the results. They found that the full implementation states, and those were states that, yes, increased enforcement and used paid advertising. Remember, the advantage of paid advertising is you can control when it gets shown, which shows, so you're reaching the audience that you're trying to reach. When they invested, on average, 14 cents per resident of the state, they got almost a 9% increase in belt use. That's really high when you consider that, at that point, most states were having maybe already 80% of people using their belt. So that was a big increase for 14 cents per citizen. Other states were increasing enforcement, but they didn't spend as much on communication, okay, this paid advertising. They spent 3.5 cents per resident. They only saw less than a 3% increase in belt use. And then the comparison states increased enforcement, that's what people think of when they think Click It or Ticket, but they didn't spend any money on advertising. And what do you see? You saw a 0.5% increase in belt use. So I think this is a really nice study that shows us, yes, the law is important, but you need to couple it with communication so your audience knows that there's a new policy or a new level of enforcement in place. An example of how communication is important with engineering is the case of head restraints. So you all have head restraints in your cars behind your neck, and the idea of them, they've been required in the United States since 1969, and they're to prevent neck injuries, which commonly referred to as whiplash injuries. But according to a study in Canada, if you look at how people adjust their restraints, if they've ever adjusted them, less than 1/5 would actually protect the person's neck adequately because of where they have it. And you can look at this tonight if you're going to drive your car and look at whether or not your head restraint is adjusted. And for 1/3 of drivers, they would have no restraint whatsoever from that safety equipment that's in their car. And when they interview drivers thought that the purpose of that head restraint was for comfort. So they had something to rest their head on. They didn't know it was to protect their neck. So it seems like when this engineering advance was made, again, no one thought of communications. People think that parts take care of itself. And so, you know, my point, communications usually always has to be part of the picture, but it's best used in combination. So kind of the summary of the points I went over today, my list, is think carefully about what role communication should play in any campaign you're involved with. Think of what target audience you're trying to impact. I see a lot of campaigns, I can't tell specifically who they're directed towards, they're generic. Conduct a needs assessment ahead of time so you know where your audience stands on the issue or the problem or the protective behavior you're trying to encourage. What are their existing attitudes? If you're going to use fear, always combine it with attention to whether the person feels they can do the protective behavior and whether they believe it works. Any campaign you come up with, you need to pre-test it and the language you're going to use and the messaging, and measure the intended as well as possible unintended effects of your campaign. Now that's kind of my list, but I pulled together some other lists for you, just some summaries of advice people had about doing risk communication or public health communication. This one comes from a handbook of health behavior research, so they tried to summarize the literature. One, allow a few months for planning, and that just feeds into what I'm saying to you, do needs assessment, right? Know your audience before you develop the campaign and pretest it. Continuous campaigns that involve repetition are much more likely to be effective than just a one-shot campaign. Similar to what I just told you, target a particular audience, and then you need to use the channels that reach those people. And again, your needs assessment, one of the things you can measure with that is how to reach those people. Where do they shop? What radio stations do they listen to? What websites do they go to? You really need to address the perceived barriers. Very often we tell people what they should do, but we have no idea why they're not doing it now. And if we don't understand why they're not doing it, how could we possibly convince them they should do it? So it's very simple stuff, but we need to find that out before we try to change behavior. Ideally, tell people what they should do, not just what they shouldn't do. And if there's any benefit to your recommendation, share that with them. Even if it's not a safety benefit, that's okay. You can convince people based on other values they have. It doesn't just have to be what you value or what's important to you. Obviously, the message should be simple yet accurate, and that's sometimes challenging. You shouldn't exaggerate the benefits. You shouldn't moralize in terms of judging people. You could consider story-based messaging. Again, I don't think the evidence is in terms of whether that's better, but I have seen some evidence that it might be better for people with low levels of education. Pre-test the draft materials. Again, there's some repetition here, but that's because different people have the same advice on their list. And then evaluate not just your long-term outcome in terms of injury or behavior, but whether you achieved the knowledge or attitude or perception changes that you were trying to accomplish with your campaign. Now, this list comes from Alan Williams. I started with a quote from Alan Williams. Again, he did a really nice summary for the Transportation Research Board about what do we know about communicating for traffic safety. And he made this list of things that don't work for traffic safety: passive messaging, just putting up a sign, giving out a pamphlet, a button. Obviously, as a standalone, that's not very effective. Same thing with slogans, you know, be sun smart, not very effective. Short-term programs that don't catch people's attention, using extreme fear techniques without giving people concrete steps of what they can do to avoid the danger. He found that the programs that were successful, these are the characteristics that they shared. Again, careful pretesting of messages, delineating a specific target group that you're trying to reach. Make sure your messages reach that group. I know a lot of people trying to reach African Americans work with churches. Well, that audience is more likely to attract older women than young men. So again, you need to find out how are you going to reach a specific group you're interested in targeting. Longer-term programs work better than one shot, as we've said. People pay more attention to new knowledge, new information. So if you can tell them something new that they haven't heard before, that's more likely to be effective. Combining the education or the information with another strategy such as law enforcement. Using models, using theories to underline your program, not just hunches, not just assumptions. Again, and he ends with that note about how to use fear and that what we found about how to use fear effectively. So, you know, I combined lists from multiple places, and I think you see some common threads, and this is really based on evidence. We're a young field in terms of evaluating injury communication, and I hope, you know, those of you who have tried this and measured your results will share it with the rest of us. I've tried to leave time for questions as I was asked to, because I know there's a ton of experience out there in the audience, and I really look forward to hearing your questions or your reactions to what I've shared with you today. Teresa?
Well, thank you. I know I've just sent out a reminder to everyone if they have any questions to be sure and get those in the chat box for us. Thank you so much. This has prompted a lot of thought. I know for me personally, I've been around a long time, and I was there when we were told don't use the word injury, and this is
accident,
very interesting. I'm sorry, accident. Yes, and even to the point here in Arkansas that we changed police officers reporting for car crashes to say, instead of accident reports, to say incident reports. So, and that's something. I know that at the beginning we had a comment, if you can see that, if you want to talk about that, from Hank, who talks about using injury instead of accidents in order to let people know about the public health approach with this, and that helped to legitimize the field. Do you have any, would you like to speak to that or any thoughts about that? I know you talked a lot about it further on in the talk because he had some early comments, but what would you say about that?
Thank you. Yes. Hi, Hank. I definitely know there's a number of issues people have with the word accident, and really I think I'm confident mostly on the one about it's not linked to the belief that things aren't preventable, but yes, there's, I know Sue Baker says that, you know, the changing of that word really made the field be taken more seriously. Before, it wasn't considered part of public health. So there may be other reasons we don't want to use the word accident. I just think it's not as important as people once thought. And the reason I usually read that people say if we use that word, people will think you can't do anything to prevent them, I don't believe that is true. But there may be other reasons that you know, the word is problematic.
Okay. We've had a question about talking a little bit more about poison prevention. Can you address that? Wendy was wanting to know about that for us.
Sure. Well, again, before I did my dissertation, which was a national survey, this was now a long time ago, I tested a lot of the language I planned to use in my questionnaire, and I did that via focus groups. And what I found is, first of all, in my focus groups, even though I said I was talking about unintentional poisoning, people tended to think a lot when they hear the word poisoning of like poisoning someone on purpose, like murdering them. It's just that's what they think of the word poisoning. And also, like I said, if they thought of, even if we got them to think about unintentional, they thought about children. So I think that, you know, perhaps, if you know, overdose is a word that the public uses for the things that we're mostly worried about in our field right now in terms of poisoning deaths. So the point with that is I think we have to understand how people are understanding our words. And rather than try to change the whole public's language, maybe we need to use their word. But we need to test how things are coming across. So clearly, I think overdose would be a better word than unintentional poisoning, if that's what you're talking about. I think it's unrealistic to change the way the whole public thinks and talks. I think it's more realistic that we learn how they think and talk, and then we adopt their, their language if we're trying to talk to them.
Okay. Jennifer asked about money. Do you have any tips? You know, a lot of these changes will take money. Do you have any tips about quick or easy?
Quick or easy money.
Money. Not just, money, but pre-testing, message testing.
No, well, she is right, and I guess I have some ideas. One is, in general, I would love it if, you know, certain grants come with the rule that X percent, like 10% of the grant, must be spent on evaluation. So, you know, for those of you who work in state health departments, if you could slowly, you know, educate people that you have contact with to build that into grants, either pretesting, formative testing. You know, pretesting is really also called formative evaluation. So just building that into grants and requiring that. Now, I know many of you don't give grants, you get grants. But I think if it's a sophisticated organization, they're not going to balk at you saying we want to pretest, we want to evaluate. They'll think more of you. And if you don't have any funds, a couple of ideas I have. Try to hook up with, say, a public health school if there's one near you, because all of their students, you know, starting in the fall when they come, need to do a project to get their MPH. I mean, a lot of you have your MPH, so you know that, and or they need to do a practicum. So they could help perhaps with data collection or data analysis for you as their master's project. And the other idea I had is perhaps some, say, ad agencies or even newspapers might do some pro bono work in the community. So you might say, would you be willing to work with us and design a campaign, you know, at no cost, and then they can kind of do it as charitable work. Those are just some ideas, but I think in the future we should try to talk as if this is normal and this should always be done. And when someone asks you to work on a problem, just say, okay, of course I'll need X, Y, and Z. Because I think when you explain to people that you need to find out what people think before you try to affect how they think, you know, it is logical, and you can say otherwise we might waste our money. If we don't even know, you know, who to target, we can't be efficient. So just that type of education may get whoever controls the dollars to just build that in and understand that that should be part of any good program.
Okay. All right, we've got some more comments and questions coming in. Campaigns that have used fear effectively, Jennifer, the fear factor here, and, you know, I just thought what, this is just my comment, I thought what you had to say about this, all of this was really on point, and it's very timely for what we're doing here in Arkansas, but also I think for all of us as we look at how do we kind of bridge the gap between what we've always done, the national campaigns that are in place, and bringing that forward. So if you could talk about specific campaigns with the, if you know of any that have used fear effectively, and then the other issue of bridging from the old to the new.
So I think that we have to think about fear of what, right? So I see a lot of the click it or ticket campaigns aimed at young people and young men. They kind of say fear of getting a ticket, right? Fear of losing your job, fear of losing money. So that's a different type of fear. I think probably it's easier to get, say, a parent to be afraid with their child than to get, like, a 19-year-old to be afraid that they're going to, you know, become disabled or something. I don't have campaigns that come to mind immediately that show that. You might want to look at, you know, that model that I presented, the person who I think designed it, her name is Witte, R-I-T-T-E. Look at articles that she wrote and see if she has examples, because she's the one who has shown that fear works. She did not work an injury per se. So no immediate campaign comes to mind that I'm aware of, but I think it depends. Like, I worked on a campaign to get people to put up pool fences, and what I found in my needs assessment is that all the mothers, these were pregnant women that had pools in their yard, were afraid of the pool already. So in that case, it wasn't necessary to increase fear because the women had fear. It was maybe necessary to explain what type of fence or explain how you get a fence, overcome resistance from the dad. That's what I mean. I can't imagine trying to do a campaign without a needs assessment because you're just operating in the total dark. So I'm sorry a campaign doesn't immediately come to mind. I'm sure there have been some. But the fear of you personally getting injured, I personally think it's very hard to overcome people's, all the defense mechanisms we have to believe that bad things are not going to usually happen to us.
Okay, I think some folks have posted talking about smoking campaigns here, that the fear issue has been effective with that.
Fear of cancer? Fear of a health outcome?
Yes, they're talking about where people, as you can see here, some of the comments about, and I don't know that I've seen this one, someone puts their money on the counter to pay for their cigarettes and the cashier asks more and they pull off part of their face. The tips campaign, that's what it is.
Yeah.
Oh, I have seen that actually. And the fear being losing your appearance, because we know that that's important.
Right.
Right. I can think of an example of one that's kind of the backwards sort of way of that, in terms of encouraging women to breastfeed.
Mm-hmm.
And we talked about all the reasons why it's important for your baby. It's this and this and this. But when the advertisements and communications had to do with you lose your after baby birth weight faster if you breastfeed, that had a lot to do with women being more attentive to breastfeeding their babies.
I know. See, that's what I think. A lot of times we have to get out of our own head because we're already doing the thing we want. Like we're already, drank the Kool-Aid. And I think we need to just get in the person's mindset. I once heard a speaker from the CDC give this interesting talk about getting women to take folic acid. And she's saying, I only wish we could say it reduces wrinkles or some type of ad like you see for all these, you know, creams and all that have, you know, supposedly vitamin E and keratin and this and that. She said, too bad we have to tell the truth. But I think the point in that is that find out what the audience values and try to make it about that, as opposed to just us, you know, one-way communication, lecturing people. I think that's what we've done for so long. And I think when we listen to people, I always find some of them have rational reasons why they're not doing what they recommend. If we just listen instead of talking at people, just listen to why they're not doing it, and then we could try to help them do it and make it possible and make it easier. But I think if we come kind of holier than thou, like we have all the answers and what's wrong with them, that they're not doing what they should, that's when they turn off to us.
Okay, well, thank you. We may have a couple of, we've got some more comments about the tips campaign. Everybody, please remember that this will be posted. We'll have audio and then the PowerPoint will be separate for you. I want you to know how just invaluable this has been for all of us, and thank you so much for your time and everyone for participating. I'm going to real quick put the dates back on here so you can check about the next calls that we'll have. And here we go, our next webinars. And thank you all very, very much, and we'll see you in August. August the 27th, if we're not on a webinar or other meeting coming soon to a computer near you. Thanks, everyone. Have a great afternoon.
And thank you for having me. I really admire your work. It's so important.
Bye-bye. Thank you. Bye-bye.